Good afternoon, everybody, again. Thank you for joining us. This is, again, another session of the BDS Monitor Live. Our speaker this afternoon is going to be Dr. Alex Jaffe, who is the editor of the BDS Monitor. And he will be discussing, obviously, the latest events, addressing some of the ramifications of yesterday's talk by Kerry, as well as UN Resolution 2334. As far as how that impacts the general environment. Of course, more importantly, not less importantly, obviously, the upcoming Modern Language Association will be taking place, their next meeting here in Philadelphia, where I am based out of, and their proposals for calls for BDS. Some housekeeping issues before we start the call. Those of you who have been on the call know the process. Those of you who have not been, let me go over the format. Alex will talk, and then we will open up the floor to, obviously, as many Q&A as we have. As far as the question and answer goes, those of you who are logged in through your computers, you will see a hand icon. Should you have a question, and we, of course, encourage you to ask as many questions as you have, please click on that icon, and that will you will raise your hand, and then I will be able to unmute you, and you'll be able to ask your question. Those of you who are on the phone, I will be able to see if you have a question, but if not, bear with our technology, and I too will be able to unmute you and ask your question. If not, to everybody on the phone and on the computer, you can always send us an email to bdsmonitor@spme.org. Again, bdsmonitor@spme.org. If I get those questions while we are in session, I will be able to read those questions and Alex will respond. If not, we will respond in a timely fashion after the call. So without further ado, let's start our call. Alex, the floor is yours.
Okay, thanks. Well, thank you again to everyone for joining us on what is a rather dreary afternoon here in the East. I hope it's sunnier wherever you are. Unfortunately, what we have to talk about today is far from sunny. But I want to preface my remarks at least by saying and really by emphasizing that SPME is a non-political organization. We don't take a stand on elections or political parties or things like that. We can't. We don't. And we came into some criticism last month for comments about the U.S. presidential election and the implications for BDS and for opposing BDS. And for better and for worse, I'm afraid we're in the same kind of situation this month, discussing in particular United Nations Security Council Resolution 2334, and the comments yesterday by Secretary of State John Kerry. Unfortunately, I think it's fair to say that that these two events will be a boon for the BDS movement. My personal feeling is that they will do very little to advance the cause of peace in the Middle East, but more immediately for our concerns, they will help revitalize the BDS movement, which has been hasn't had a very good year, really, in 2016. It's had more failures than it has successes. If we back up a little bit, the U.S. Helped orchestrate, along with, it seems, Britain and New Zealand, a resolution that was put forward originally by Egypt in the U.N. Security Council. Under Title 6 of the UN Charter, which is a non-binding recommendation rather than under Title 7, which is a binding binding policy, which basically states that Israeli settlements, quote-unquote, have no legal validity, and stating that the Security Council and, by extension, the United Nations and the international community would not recognize changes to the so-called 1967 border, which is just the 1949 armistice line, except those agreed to through negotiations. The resolution makes no distinction between Israeli communities in east of the Green Line. It defines all of those territories as Palestinian, and it calls on states to, quote, distinguish in their relevant dealings between the territory of the State of Israel and the territories occupied since 1967. Now, there are lots of different dimensions to this. The rather covert, if not downright underhanded, way in which the resolution was formulated, put forward, rejected under political pressure from Egypt, from Israel, and President-elect Donald Trump, and then pushed again at the urging of the United States, Britain, and New Zealand with the agreement of Senegal and Venezuela, which was then denied, and all this very convoluted and, I think, unfortunate political process. And but what does it really mean for the BDS movement? This is where the damage really will be done. Secretary Kerry's walking back in contradictions in yesterday, his address yesterday, notwithstanding. For one thing, the clause that calls on the international community to differentiate in their relevant dealings between Israeli entities within the pre-1967 borders, so-called, will limit the international community's, theoretically, limit the international community's ability to deal with, for one thing, Israeli government institutions, such as the Justice Ministry and the Police Ministry, which are located in East Jerusalem, not to mention various Israeli corporations and business entities and other institutions such as universities, which have bases or branches in the territories, so-called. The resolution also potentially exposes Israeli citizens and institutions to lawsuits in the International Criminal Court, to the boycott and labeling efforts, to blacklists such as that which is already being undertaken by the United Nations Human Rights Council, to labeling efforts by the European Union, by labeling efforts undertaken by European states, NGOs, and corporate entities. Again, for better and for worse, Israeli entities, banks, universities, corporations that do business all over the entity of Israel on both sides of the so-called Green Line are now exposed to some kind of legal liability, further legal liability. Now, there's a debate about how this will really play out. Not least of all, because incoming Trump administration has indicated that there will be changes afoot after January 20th. These have not yet been specified. To my mind, though, these kinds of international political, legal, and economic kinds of BDS initiatives are the section of the iceberg that is visible above the waterline. And these are the things that are most easily combated. Banks and universities and the European Union and labeling and things like that, these are all visible policies, and these can all be opposed and have been opposed with some considerable success particularly in the past year. They become known, people complain, and more often than not they have been reversed or walked back or explained away and downplayed and so on. To my mind, though, the real damage will be below the waterline, and that is how this resolution, which again is not binding, it's a recommendation, but that's a distinction that will be lost on the vast majority of observers, willfully lost, willfully disguised, by NGOs and by local politicians and by supermarket chains and by academic associations and university committees deciding on whether to invite an Israeli scholar and church groups and, of course, NGOs who already seem to be raising money on the basis of this resolution. And these are the kinds of things that comprise the bulk of the BDS movement. Local initiatives that go on really somewhat beyond the range of normal political perception and media perception. These are things that we at BDS Monitor and other organizations that deal with the BDS issue sometimes hear about. They're sometimes brought to our attention, and sometimes the only way that we find out is after the fact, when arguments such as this, United Nations has declared that Israeli activity beyond the Green Line is illegal, so the argument might go. When these are used in divestment vote debates at colleges and universities, student governments, and things like that. So this is a very damaging resolution, and ironically, it came at a point when the BDS movement as a whole was, in my perception, at a rather low point. It hasn't been a great year for the BDS movement. Internationally, in terms of international politics and economics, or at the local level, let's say at colleges with divestment initiatives, where there have been very, very few successes this year and many, many setbacks. The politics behind this are very sensitive issue, and I will only say that this resolution and Kerry's very controversial follow-up speech of yesterday, in which he articulated parameters for what he regards as an acceptable Israeli-Palestinian peace initiative or scenario, these have been soundly criticized by members of both American political parties who feel that they have been sandbagged and that, you know, Israel and the peace process have been sandbagged by this, and that it has intensified divides within the Democratic Party in particular, and I think quite predictably and quite unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on your point of view, it threatens American support for the United Nations as a whole, both financially and morally. And there are rumblings from Republican senators, as well as from Democratic senators, that the UN will pay a price, possibly in terms of direct American funding, as a result of this resolution. So, for whatever reason, with how long is it now? 22 days left to the Obama administration, we find ourselves, and everybody finds themselves, in a rather different position than we were a week ago with respect to BDS, with respect to the Arab-Israeli Peace Initiative, and with respect to certain structures of the international system as a whole. Again, why now is a puzzlement, and I encourage people to read widely the various commentaries and speculations regarding this. You know, again, 2016 wasn't a good year for the BDS movement, and particularly on campuses, it really wasn't such a great year. And this is reflected again in the number of unsuccessful boycott and divestment resolutions that were proposed in student governments. Student governments are, at least in my mind, a fairly trivial aspect of the political economics of universities, but a rather telling leading indicator of beliefs and identities and social trends on universities and more broadly. And some of this success, I think, has been translated into a growing trend of what I would describe as petulance on the part of the BDS movement on campus. On the one hand, you have, you know, more intersectional alliances, really hijackings by the BDS movement of other nominally more popular or at least more successful kinds of social movements like Black Lives Matter, and now more recently anti-Trump protests. But really the other side of this is just out and out petulance. And so for example, there was a conference organized by a pro-Israel group at Columbia University in December, which was billed as an indigenous peoples event, where pro-Israel groups got other indigenous peoples, in addition to Jews who are indigenous to their ancestral homeland in Israel, and had a conference. And the Students for Justice in Palestine branch at Columbia had a kind of petulant frenzy about this and organized a walkout of the conference. And there have been a number of these foot stamping kinds of displays that have gone on, and to the which I think are rather embarrassing for the BDS movement, but I'm sure they see it rather differently. But it's very difficult to predict where things are going to be going now in 2017, particularly with the Security Council resolution and the change in American policy. What we do know and what we can count on, and what I'm afraid we can always count on, is for academic associations to be the battleground for these kinds of tensions to be played out. And unfortunately, early in January, the Modern Language Association, which is one of the largest academic associations in the country, will be debating three separate BDS resolutions in their essentially what is their members meeting, and if it's approved by this delegates assembly, the resolutions will go forward to the membership at large for a vote. And these resolutions, in short, not only call on the Modern Language Association to endorse the BDS movement, but to honor the call, which is to say to participate in the boycott of Israeli institutions, organizations, and scholars. It's very difficult to predict, obviously, how it's going to turn out. Similar kinds of resolutions were defeated in the last year, and 2 years really, at other first-line, first-rate academic associations like the American Anthropological Association and the American Historical Association. The Modern Language Association has a very long kind of radical tradition going back at least to the early 1970s. And English departments, let's call them that, have for the past two or three decades a very strong subculture of anti-colonial, anti-imperial so-called sentiment and anti-Israel, anti-Zionist sentiment. And these new resolutions build on that. And there's been the usual kinds of shenanigans with the organization itself, saying it doesn't take a stance but covertly promoting these resolutions by giving the small minority of BDS activists within its ranks a sort of unprecedented access to the organization's resources and membership at large. So we really don't know how it's going to play out. And if it does, it will be significant. I should say also that there are already a number of warnings that have been issued by anti-BDS organizations, including the Louis V. Brandeis Center, warning the Modern Language Association that it risks its tax-exempt status if it violates the terms of its own charter and adopts an explicitly political political stance that discriminates against a minority of racial, ethnic, religious, or national origin. These kinds of threats or warnings seem to have been influential with the American Anthropological Association, although we can't measure exactly how or how much. And there are other organizations which have threatened, or which have proposed, rather, to change their bylaws to make themselves explicitly political, or that is to say, to allow themselves to adopt explicitly political stances, specifically supporting BDS. So we'll have to see. It's very unclear. But going into the new year, the BDS movement is revitalized. There are some key challenges ahead. I think it is fair to say that no one is really quite sure what the new administration is going to do on these issues, except in as much as some of the cabinet appointments have been of individuals who have taken very strong stances against BDS. So it will be a whole new scene in 2017, and I think the one thing we can count on is much work to be done and much aggravation going forward, and new challenges. So with that, let me end it right there, and let's see if we can take some questions.
Thank you so much, Al. We're now going to start the Q&A session. So again, if you have questions, you can click on the hand icon, and I will be able to answer to unmute you and ask, and you'll be able to ask your question. So again, feel free. The hand icon is listed on the control panel, and if you have questions, feel free to ask now. Down the list. So while we wait, Alex, you know, let me take the prerogative. I'll ask the first question just to continue the conversation here. So as a result of everything you've mentioned correctly, and of course a result of the MLA's upcoming vote, do you see a direct catalyst in support of the passing of the MLA, where last time I went to a referendum, they had a lot of conversations, now it's up again, that this will be you know, the final kind of push as a result of using the administration, the outgoing administration and Kerry's remarks to push this along, and you see, of course, as being adopted by the next as far as the anthropologists, the historians, and whatnot, as we go forward.
Well, in poking around a bit today and yesterday, I haven't yet seen the Modern Language Association promoters of the BDS resolution mention this Security Council resolution or Kerry's speech yet. And obviously we're in between semesters and everyone is out on vacation and recovering from their Christmas and Hanukkah hangovers and getting ready for their New Year's hangovers. So I think it's a little too early to see whether the MLA types will be using this as a talking point. I suspect they will, if not now, then down the line. I will say that one of the things that distinguished the American Anthropological Association debate, or the larger environment about the BDS resolution in the Anthropological Association, was that the opponents were very well organized. They and this is the same that should be said of the American Historical Association. The opponents saw this coming for a long time, months, more than months, a year. They began organizing themselves into a counter group many months in advance. They were very articulate in their opposition, and I don't need to recount all of their points, but they went in having made their case, I think, about as well as they could before they got to the actual business meeting where all of this played out. It's not clear to me whether opponents of this resolution within the Modern Language Association have done the same or to the same extent. Now, I, you know, as it happens, I am familiar with the American Anthropological Association. I know a number of the people some of the people on the inside, and I come out of that discipline as an archaeologist. So maybe these things are just were just more visible to me, but I'm not really seeing it among the MLA types. And if nothing else, that's the lesson, that will be the lesson, is that you have to be organized well in advance, and you have to dedicate time and resources and energy and deal with aggravation and opprobrium for a long period in advance unfortunately, at the expense of all the other things that that you want to do, in order to make your case effectively and to defeat these resolutions. And we will see if the MLA folks have gotten their acts together enough. I hope so.
Okay. So we have a few questions that were actually written, and let me see if I can get the individuals to ask their questions. It'll be easier to hear it from them directly. One was from, Daniel Mitchell. Let's see if Daniel, we can hear him. Daniel, are you here?
Hello.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Go ahead.
Yes, I had typed this question in, but there are various federal and state laws and regulations that prohibit discrimination on the basis of national origin or religion and so on. Yet you can have deans, department chairs, other university officials who endorse BDS. What is the status of such individuals, or could they be challenged in those positions of authority because of their endorsement of a form of national origin and possibly religious discrimination?
Well, this is where I have to say, first of all, that I'm not a lawyer, so I can't say give legal advice or be too authoritative about this. My understanding is, let me back up a half a step and say that one would think that this would be possible. The problem is that there are a number of intersecting, shall we say, problems or interests. And the argument is always made that BDS and to a certain extent, institutionalized discrimination against Israelis, Jews, and supporters of Israel falls under free speech and academic freedom kinds of provisions, constitutional and institutional, and that regulations which seek to limit the ability of individuals and organizations such as departments to express their feelings and to act on their feelings in a concrete institutional fashion contravene basically the right to free speech and the rights to academic freedom. And I, as a non-lawyer, do not know how to square this circle. Remember also that most BDS activities, as I said earlier, go on below the waterline, and departmental decisions about giving someone a fellowship or hiring someone. These are all but invisible in terms of their expressions of overt discrimination. Almost never do hiring committees or promotion and tenure committees come out and say, we're not interested in you because of your political stance on Israel, or because you have a degree from the wrong university. Now, occasionally, these kinds of things do get expressed, particularly in terms of dealings with tenured faculty. And in those cases, allegations are typically, and you'll forgive me if I sound too cynical, are typically buried within the university chain of command. my personal feeling is that we need more lawsuits and threats of lawsuits, and we need more actionable evidence. And you know, one of the ironies of the modern university environment, the 21st century university environment, is that everyone is under a microscope for everything that they say, and that students are recording everyone's faculty members' comments in class about this and that, and posting them on the internet in order to create imagined and sometimes real controversies. Well, we have to do this also, frankly, and we need more evidence, and the concrete evidence has been lacking. And I think that when the concrete evidence is there of harassment, of institutional harassment, of institutional or personal discrimination, then there will be and there should be lawsuits. And what I don't think is necessarily helpful are broad kinds of allegations against institutions as a whole in terms of which one is more bad for Jewish students. I mean, this is a function of the sort of list obsession that that permeates the internet. But let me just conclude this long-winded answer by saying that examples like these academic associations who adopt BDS and say so are big, juicy targets for lawsuits. And we saw this with the American Studies Association, we saw the threats against the American Anthropological Association, and now the Modern Language Association. And I think it would be terrific to have a lawsuit and to go into the discovery phase and get all the emails that went into these resolutions, and to show how the organizations supported them tacitly while claiming that they didn't until the vote was clear, and then they did, and in some kind of ersatz democratic fashion. So I think there's much more to be done. I think much more will be done going forward in the legal sphere.
Great, thank you. Let's go on to I saw our friend Ken Lassen had a question. Ken, can you hear us?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Yeah. Go ahead.
I don't think that lawsuits are the way to go, with all due respect. You can't really dismiss free speech and academic freedom very easily, as far as I'm concerned. I'm fourscore against the BDS movement, but I don't think they hide behind free speech. I think they exercise their freedom of speech and academic freedom, and I think the way to combat that is the way that we've been doing in the past few years, and as was pointed out in the past year, it's been pretty successful, and that's with so-called better speech. And I think that lawsuits can be counterproductive in this area.
Well, again, as a non-lawyer,
I should qualify that I speak as a constitutional law professor at the University of Baltimore. I am a lawyer. That's qualifies my opinion, I guess.
Well, I defer on that basis. On that basis alone, I will say that again, my perception is that the addition of legal ammunition to our side of the equation has been extremely helpful. And I mean, I certainly don't propose suing people willy-nilly, and I don't even know how you go about suing somebody or anything like that. But to my mind, there's been a palpable change in the playing field since a number of organizations have begun to weigh in precisely on legal terms. Perhaps this is an unfortunate development, at least in the sense of Americans exercising their inherently litigious nature.
Don't get me wrong. I think the Brandeis Center in particular has been effective in this regard, and I'm all for a lawsuit that would be against an individual or a group who would engage in active and palpable intimidation or coercion against students, whether it's a professor or other students, and I think a lawsuit might be the way to go there. I thought you were talking about lawsuits against these educational organizations, so-called educational organizations, like the MLA and American Historical Association, whatever, the Anthropological Association, whichever one's come up with BDS resolutions. I don't think the lawsuit is the way to go there, but certainly against individuals and groups that actively intimidate.
Well, I think the thing we would agree on here is that we need better documentation of instances of active discrimination and harassment. And to those who are listening, and to the broader audience on our side, we need to be collecting, we need to be documenting these things in a much better fashion than we are now. When to sue and on what basis is far beyond my competence, but we need more detail, and we need more information generally, because what we hear about is too often anecdotal and too often after the fact, and too often lacks a real documentary trail that could potentially stand up in court or be used in court in some fashion. And I would only add here that the other side has become extremely active in this way. And I'll cite one particularly ludicrous example from December, and that's a threat by Palestine Legal, which is basically the legal defense arm of Students for Justice in Palestine, leveled some threats at Kent State University, which refused to take down the mural of Golda Meir, which Palestinian or Muslim students or someone found threatening. This demand was dismissed more or less out of hand by the university, and Palestine Legal is rumbling about legal action. That doesn't mean that we have to stoop to their level, only that we have to be equipped to play the game, and that this is part of the game, so to speak, now.
Great, thank you. Let's go to, know that Robbie Friedman also had a few questions. Let's see if Robbie's here. Robbie, you're here?
Yes.
All right.
Can you hear me?
We can hear you. The floor is yours.
Hi. Well, I sort of wanted to talk about two comments in Kerry's remarks, one that he said and one that he didn't. He was talking about the end of conflict, and I think that we should use that as a leverage in any discussion about BDS incitement, because it is about eventually negotiations, which is what he did not say, because that is the bilateral part that has been now on a trajectory to the UN instead of the parties involved. And I'm saying all of this because in early December I participated in a conference on incitement in New York, and most of the aspects there were legal, and I fully appreciate the comments that were made by the constitutional law professor, and I apologize for not catching your name, but I think that we are looking at an elephant from several different perspectives, and one describes the elephant and, you know, the story from, you know, the legs and the trunk and then the tail, but not the elephant itself. And I think it's about time that we use a multi-pronged approach, and I think that the strongest one that we can use, instead of always being reactive, and that is still necessary, I think is a moral call for the justness of our cause. I don't want to dismiss the justness of any other cause, but it's an either or zero sum game, and I think we need to get out of that quagmire.
Well, I certainly agree, and this has been the problem with opposing BDS from the beginning, and it is inherently reactive, and it needs to and it needs to put forward a positive vision about how the conflict should be addressed and maybe even resolved. I think the problem is, again, from my perspective as someone who is up to his knees or beyond in the things that elephants leave behind, I think the problem is that there's a lot coming at us, and articulating a positive message, and I don't want to make a positive message sound Pollyanna-ish or naive, but a clearer vision about the need for negotiations and that this is the only strategy that will resolve the conflict in any form. I'm up to my ears, but I'm glad that you mentioned this, because I would encourage listeners and others that you all have to get involved with SPME and with other organizations and at the local level in order to precisely articulate these kinds of messages in ways that are as simple as writing a letter to the editor and as logistically complicated as organizing for speakers to come to your school or community to talk about these issues, about what the conflict really is and how to really resolve the Arab-Israeli conflict. And as well, to get involved with organizations that are doing something in ways that reflect your particular vision or values about the conflict and about its resolution. Heaven knows there is no lack of organizations on really any side of the equation, but on the pro-Israel side, in terms of Jewish organizations and Christian organizations and many others, they need new voices. They need new support. They need to be kicked in the pants or elsewhere in order to keep articulating what the problems really are. And I don't know whether that is what you're talking about, or
well, yes, I don't know. I think you are right on target, but I think in terms of strategy, obviously, and you sort of mentioned that the speech by Kerry and of course the UNSC resolution will embolden Palestinian demands for more boycott and more of the same. And I'm wondering if we shouldn't use that as a leverage or as a jumping board or whatever metaphor you want to use, and say, okay, you know, there is a conflict and there is an issue of negotiations. You know, how do we move forward? And we don't have to stoop to the level of maligning them for what they do, but the real problem that I found is, let's say that Israel is a horrible violator of international law. Well, there are civilized ways of resolving it if somebody doesn't like building houses in East Jerusalem or the West Bank. But somehow the problem that I found with his speech is that he equates the right to murder with the building of houses. I'm not in favor of building houses, but I'm definitely not in favor of killing people, and intellectually I'm even less in favor of putting them on the same plateau. And that is, I think, one of the biggest deficiencies of Kerry, of making asymmetric arguments in this. And I just spent the other part of this morning for about an hour with a JCPA call. I don't know if anybody of you did that. And it sounded to me like, you know, things are still as usual. And I'm not so sure that they are as usual anymore.
Well, you can go beyond that and point to some of the contradictions between the UN resolution, which makes no distinction between settlement blocks, between Jerusalem and far-flung settlements, and Kerry's right. remarks, where he articulated that yes, settlement blocks are going to remain part of Israel, and you can point at Marwan Barghouti's comments of yesterday or today, saying, well, we're not going to recognize a Jewish state, we're not giving up on the right of return, and we're not going to share Jerusalem. And it's all of these kinds of so. And here let me qualify this and say that I only speak for myself. I can't speak for SPME or for any organization. Here, I think, is the great tragedy of this whole affair. At the end of December, at the 11th hour of the Obama administration, is that all of these things contradict one another. All of these things are non-starters with the Palestinians, and they serve only to further the delegitimization of Israel in the international community and at local levels. And the whole business is that would appear to be the only point of this whole enterprise on the part of the UN and Kerry. And it's an enormous setback for the peace process. And look, Netanyahu, after the UN vote, Netanyahu started warning ministers in his cabinet not to talk about annexing the West Bank, because that would be additional bad PR. And we can debate about the utility or the wisdom of his own moves after that vote, but objectively, to the extent that objectivity is possible in this upside down world of the Arab-Israeli conflict, I think this whole business is an enormous setback. Not least of all, perhaps above all, in terms of BDS, which simply acts as a multiplier for working against normalization between Israelis and Palestinians, and which is simply a mechanism for delegitimization of Israel internationally and within local contexts, which causes Israelis on all parts of the political spectrum, but obviously mostly on the right, to dig in their own heels, and it vilifies liberals Israelis as much as it does right-wing Israelis, and it makes no sense at all unless you have a larger theory about motives, and that's where I should end my comments.
Let me thank you both, but let me try to keep us on the clock. We have a few more minutes, so I just want to get one more question in before we wrap it up in effort of time. Thank you, Robbie, and obviously we're happy to continue the conversation offline if you want. Hold on. So the next question, this is an effort of time to maintain. I'll read it. It's from Herbert Friedrich. So the question that was asked has been, do we have any information about the leadership of the Democratic National Committee, and was wondering about the support for BDS amongst some of the candidates, something that we spoke about, I think, during two calls ago, but and obviously worth revisiting here. So, Alex?
Well, again, this is a very sensitive area, and I do not wish to be seen as meddling excessively in Democratic Party politics. That said, the person who put himself forward to replace Debbie Wasserman was Keith Ellison of Minnesota, and he remains the leading candidate. He's, as was mentioned in last month's BDS Monitor, he's comes out of the Nation of Islam. He's some sort of Sunni Muslim himself. He represents a district in Minneapolis that is has a large Muslim population. He's a BDS supporter. He has been a 9/11 truther. He went to Saudi Arabia on pilgrimage on the with the support of an American Muslim organization that is part of the larger Muslim Brotherhood network. Now, when his nomination was put forward, there was a real firestorm for a couple of weeks inside and outside of the party. And lots of people weighed in, including the Obama administration. And there were a number of reports which indicated that the White House was not interested in seeing him become head of the Democratic National Committee. There don't seem to be other candidates who've been put forward at this point. There are a couple of names which have been floated, and honestly, I can't remember who they are at this point. There's been no serious debate. The party is obviously in disarray after the election, and I think it's fair to say that they're still in a position of counting their losses after the national election, after the presidential election, and after the toll nationally has been added up. Since the Obama administration took over, in the last 4 years, there have been something like over 1,000 Democratic officials at all levels, national, state, and local, who've lost their elections, and the party is. Again, in a kind of a shambles. And this Security Council resolution and Kerry's remarks are only going to make things worse, because party leaders like Schumer, Chuck Schumer of New York, were very outspoken in their expressions of anger and disappointment. Now, Schumer's a strange case, and I don't want to rag on him unnecessarily, but for him to get riled up and to go against the administration is a kind of significant development. So I don't know what's going to happen. Personally, my long-standing prediction for several years has been that the Democratic Party as a whole will fracture and has fractured and will essentially turn into something resembling the British Labour Party, which is the party. Let me leave that there. It's really a separate discussion. But I think the long and the short of it is that the Democratic Party is in a shambles, and it's a little too early still to predict what that means for its positions on Israel and Arab-Israeli peace and for BDS. So maybe next month we'll have a better idea.
Great. Maybe that'll be the topic for next month. Thank you. Thank you, Alex. Thank you all for attending. We went a little bit over time, but I think it was a very fruitful and a very important conversation, as always. I'd like to take the opportunity to wish everybody, those of us who are still celebrating Hanukkah, Happy Hanukkah, and obviously to wish everybody a Happy New Year. Obviously, we will continue the conversation. We encourage everybody to be in touch if they have further questions via email, bdsmonitor@spme.org. We will definitely let everybody know about our next call next month. Thank you, Alex, and thank you, everybody, for attending, and Happy New Year again.
Take care. Have a Happy New Year, all.